Hello, my name is Dr. Duncan Rosario. I'm a general surgeon at Oakville Trafalgar Memorial Hospital, and I'm the chief of surgery at Oakville Trafalgar Memorial Hospital. I'm one of the faculty presenting today on perioperative components for SSI reduction. I have no relevant disclosures for this presentation. This program is provided by HMP Education, an HMP global company, supported by an educational grant from 3M Healthcare Medical Solutions Division. Our objectives today are to review ERAS protocols and the NSQIP perioperative components with a focus on surgical site infection bundles to reduce surgical site infections. We will also be reviewing how to implement an SSI reduction program, how to implement change in your organization. We'll be discussing the importance of maintaining normal thermia and the formulations of skin antiseptics and application methods. The famous business writer, Adam Grant, tweeted, "If at first you don't succeed, you're in luck. Effortless excellence is a lousy teacher and a fickle friend. The achievements we savor most start with a struggle and end with hard-earned mastery. Success is sweeter and more repeatable if it's the product of deliberate practice." And that certainly applies to healthcare. Today, we'll be discussing why a surgical bundle can stack multiple low-powered interventions and improve outcomes. We'll be discussing how to overcome barriers to change and implement meaningful change in an organization to implement an SSI bundle. And we'll be talking about how to succeed and be happy in healthcare. In our organization, we joined the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program in April of 2015. We started our data collection, and after 6 months of data collection, we identified that we had a significant problem. Our surgical site infection rate was 3.3%, which put us in the eighth decile, which means we were at the bottom of the NSQIP group. We put together an action team comprised of our director of surgery, our surgical clinical reviewer, and myself. At the time, I was the surgeon champion for NSQIP, and we had a focus on two particular complications: urinary tract infections and primarily surgical site infections. And I'd like to talk about the bundle. As part of our data analysis, we discovered the early widespread use of surgical site infection bundles. Reducing surgical site infections requires implementation of a variety of interventions if one hopes to have significant success. We reviewed the SSI bundle in this paper from JAMA Surgery. We also reviewed guidelines that came out from the World Health Organization in 2016, its global guidelines for the prevention of surgical site infections. We reviewed another organization's SSI bundle in JAMA, May of 2017. And then we developed our Oakville SSI reduction bundle. It comprised a number of preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative changes. And as you can see on this slide, we will go over these components individually. We implemented preoperative chlorhexidine showers. We improved our perioperative skin antisepsis. We introduced the universal application of mechanical bowel preps with oral antibiotics. We moved hair clipping outside the operating room. We stopped the routine use of the open appendectomy. We improved our use of preoperative antibiotics where clinically indicated with appropriate redosing. We introduced universal double gloving. We introduced the use of fascial wound protectors. We also introduced the use of closing bundles for laparotomies and introduced education on minimizing traffic into and out of the operating room. And we'll be discussing these on an individual basis. Preoperative measures. Smoking is a significant risk factor for surgical site infections. We used a regional initiative for the reduction of smoking pre-op with the objective of stopping smoking 30 days before surgery. We introduced a mechanical bowel preparation using a picosalax-based agent combined with oral neomycin and oral metronidazole. We rationalized our use of preoperative antibiotics, starting with a standard baseline dose of 2 grams of cefazolin, 3 grams if the patient's over 120 kilograms, with routine repeat dosing at 4 hours. We introduced preoperative chlorhexidine showers, moved hair clipping out of the operating room, and as I mentioned, we stopped the open appendectomy on a routine basis. Bowel preparations have had a variety of degrees of application in the field of colorectal surgery. This pivotal paper in Annals of Surgery came out in 2015, which demonstrated very clearly a statistical significance in the reduction of surgical site infection if both mechanical bowel preps were combined with the use of oral antibiotics. Preoperative antibiotics have been demonstrated to be of tremendous value in the reduction of surgical site infections. At issue was the dosing for cefazolin. This paper, which came out in Infectious Diseases in Clinical Practice in 2013, demonstrated the value of routinely using 2 grams of cefazolin for surgical site infection prophylaxis, not 1 gram, increasing to 3 grams if patients are over 120 kilograms. The other important change was redosing. Every 4 hours, that is for cases of a duration more than 4 hours, every 4 hours the cefazolin needs to be redosed. And we implemented this by the use of a timer via our anesthesiologist. Preoperative showers with chlorhexidine have been demonstrated in the cardiac surgery literature and other specialties to reduce the incidence of surgical site infections. We introduced on a program basis the routine use of preoperative chlorhexidine using 4% chlorhexidine for all of our patients receiving cutaneous skin incisions for surgery. We also stopped the routine performance of hair clipping in the operating room with the concern that clipping hair increases the dispersal of particulates in the operating room, which can be correlated with surgical site infections. So we moved hair clipping to a dedicated zone in our day surgical clinic out of the operating room. The operative measures we introduced included a standardized use of skin preparation with a standardized technique, the universal application of active warming for targeted normothermia, appropriate use of cefazolin with standardized dosing of 2 or 3 grams. We introduced the use of routine fascial wound barriers for laparotomies, routine double gloving with changes of the exterior glove every 60 minutes, or when perforation is identified. We introduced closing bundles, wound irrigation, appropriate wound management, and control of the OR door opening. And we'll be discussing these measures individually. Targeted normothermia is a very important part of surgical site infection reduction. Hypothermic patients are at increased risk of surgical site infections. And Hypothermia is a very common result of being in the operating room, a combination of the low temperature at which the operating room is kept, open abdomens, increase heat loss at a significant level, and when patients are under general anesthesia and paralyzed, the loss of the shivering reflex also contributes to hypothermia. Pre-warming, that is, actively warming patients before the surgical procedure starts, results in what's called banking of heat, so that the heat loss that occurs when the surgical procedure starts can be balanced with active warming of the patient. Skin preparation is also a very important of surgical site infection reduction. The standard skin preparation in use in most operating rooms now is a combination of chlorhexidine and isopropyl alcohol. Chlorhexidine has a unique characteristic called substantivity, and that is chlorhexidine can bind to the stratum corneum in the skin layer, and it is slowly released in the postoperative period to provide ongoing reduction in surgical site infections. Surgical site infections can result from commensal skin flora, that is the natural bacteria present in skin appendages. Surgical site infection can also result from released enteric flora when bowel is open during colonic resections. Important when it comes to skin preparation is not only what agent is used, it's also how it's used. The chlorhexidine isopropyl combination needs to be applied in a standardized format. It's very important to use light friction. That is, skin preparation is not a painting, it's a rubbing of the solution on the skin, because the light friction helps get the chlorhexidine into the stratum corneum to enhance the property of substantivity. It's also important to prevent pooling, as the isopropyl alcohol has a fire risk when used with cautery. It's also important to allow the skin antiseptic to dry for 3 minutes. So my practice in the operating room is I prep all of my patients myself, so that when I go out to scrub, by the time I'm gowned and I start covering the patient with the surgical drapes, I know that 3 minutes has elapsed and that's appropriate time for the skin antiseptic to dry. We initially were using bottles of skin antisepsis. And these skin antiseptics, there were concerns about expiration of the bottle, what volume of antiseptic was being applied. So we moved to standardized pre-dosed sponges for all of our skin preparation to ensure uniformity in how we were applying the skin antiseptic. We also had an education campaign to teach all of our surgical staff and nursing staff. And on the bulletin boards in our operating rooms, we have this document, Key Points for Surgical Prep. The fascial wound barrier was another important addition to the SSI reduction bundle. We know that when laparotomies are performed, contamination of skin, subcutaneous fatty layer, and fascia is a key mechanism for surgical site infection. So covering after the laparotomy incision is made, covering the skin, subcutaneous fatty tissue, and the fascia is important to prevent or minimize the degree of enteric bacterial contamination to these layers. This is an early version of how we were covering the skin and subcutaneous tissue using a Vi bag. And this is what we currently use, the Alexis Wound Protector, which is a combination of retractor and protector at the same time, comes in a variety of sizes and has been tremendously popular for our surgical staff. Double gloving is another important initiative when it comes to SSI reduction. We know that the longer one is performing surgery, the higher the risk of glove perforation, and it has been clearly demonstrated that double gloving reduces the exposure of patients to the skin flora of operating room staff and also protects our operating room staff from bloodborne pathogens during surgical procedures. So we introduced the application of universal double gloving in our operating rooms. A closing bundle was another important addition to our SSI reduction bundle. Over the course of surgery, surgical instruments, sponges, gloves can be contaminated with enteric bacteria when bowels are open in the performance of colonic resections. So what we introduced was a closing bundle. And so at the end of the case, we change our gloves, our outer gloves, and we introduce unused sterile instruments for the performance of closure of the abdominal wall. In addition, to reduce the contamination of skin, subcutaneous fatty tissue, and fascia by enteric organisms or interperitoneal organisms, we also introduced the use of the PulseVac. The PulseVac is pressurized irrigation. This was developed for the use by our colleagues in orthopedic surgery to reduce SSI incidence in hip and knee arthroplasties. And the advantage of this device is it uses pressurized sterile saline to mechanically debride skin, subcutaneous tissue, and fascia to reduce bacterial contamination. Wound management is also important. It's important to use an appropriate waterproof dressing that allows monitoring of the incision and changing of the dressing as required after surgery. Operating rooms in the modern era use controlled laminar airflow to minimize the presence of particulates and contamination at the level of the operating room table. Every time the operating room door is opened, the negative pressure and laminar airflow in the operating room is disrupted. So we introduced an education campaign to minimize the use of the opening of the outer door to encourage our staff to enter through the sterile inner core. And in terms of post-operative management, we introduced the use of sterile dressings changed every 24 hours, and with the change of dressing, cleansing of the incision using chlorhexidine. We also introduced the use of virtual visits to assess the status of patient incisions. In the modern era, a lot of surgery is done as day surgery or with very short inpatient stays. So we used a virtual care application to allow patients to send us incisional photographs to monitor patients after surgery to intervene in the case of surgical site infections. What happened with the introduction of our surgical site infection bundle? So as I mentioned, we joined the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program in 2015. We collected data for 6 months. We introduced our intervention and collected data for another 6 months. Our pre and post intervention groups had very similar demographics. However, our incidence of surgical site infection dropped from 3.3% in the pre-bundle group to 1% in our post-bundle group with statistical significance. We demonstrated ongoing continuous reduction in our overall surgical site infections and published our results of our implementation of a surgical site infection bundle in the Canadian Journal of Surgery. We continue to write about the importance of surgical quality in a variety of publications. And in fact, due to our significant reduction in surgical site infections, we won an award from the American College of Surgeons for being in the top 10% of all NSQIP hospitals. And now I'd like to talk a little bit about how to implement meaningful change. Knowing how to reduce surgical site infections and having access to the best information is not enough. How do you implement meaningful change in an organization? And for references, I would encourage everyone to read Kingdon and McDonough's work on implementation of healthcare reform. But I'd like to talk about hospital politics. Politics, fundamentally, is about who gets what. Culture, fundamentally, is about how we do things around here. So at its core, hospital politics is about who gets what around here. And if you care about how things work in your organization, if you want to implement meaningful change, such as a surgical site infection reduction bundle, you need to solve some of these challenging problems in healthcare. The model that I was describing from Kingdon and McDonough talks about the P's. The problem that you're trying to solve, the people with the power to change policy have to believe that your problem is real. Policy, you have to have a change that you are proposing to implement. Politics, the change that you want to implement has to fit what your culture will accept. And most importantly, you need a window of opportunity. You need an alignment for the Swiss cheese effect to happen, for your change to be implemented. I would recommend everyone read The Tipping Point from Malcolm Gladwell. But I would say the key model for implementing change is the Cotter model. And I would encourage everyone to read Cotter's article from Harvard Business School or his book on the topic of the Cotter model, how to meaningfully implement change in healthcare. The other important thing to remember when you're trying to implement change in healthcare is you don't need to get 100% of the people in your organization on board. You need a tipping point. You need about 15 to 16%, the early innovators and early adopters, to implement your change before you will start to see a cascade of the early majority and a tipping point where you will see meaningful and widespread implementation of effective change. The other important thing to focus on is automating things, is to focus on process, not people. So to implement our standardized preoperative chlorhexidine bundle shower before patients have surgery, we implemented an education campaign, and we placed this document in the pre-admission clinic envelopes that all of our patients receive, so that in addition to being informed about the importance of using chlorhexidine by our pre-admission clinic nurses, our patients have this document easily available for them. We also have a supply of chlorhexidine in our hospital pharmacy to reduce friction, to make it very easy to obtain the necessary preoperative antisepsis. We also audit our results. When patients arrive for surgery, our nursing staff assess how compliant they have been with our SSI bundle. Did they take their mechanical bowel prep? Did they do the preoperative carbohydrate loading as part of the ERAS protocol? Did they take the oral antibiotics as part of our audit process? Because we need to know if the change that we believe is being implemented is being effectively implemented. Change is difficult. There are numerous challenges in healthcare, and I would like to end with this note, with a focus on compassion. A quote from Martin Luther King: Power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love, implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. In healthcare, we need to demonstrate compassion not only for our patients, but for our colleagues and for ourselves. I thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss surgical site infections and the components of SSI reduction bundles. And I thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Dr. Rosario. I'm very happy to speak to you today on a subject that I'm passionate about, and that's ERAS, Enhanced Recovery After Surgery. Today, I'd like to review the perioperative components of ERAS, offer some tips on successful implementation, and explore the importance of maintaining normothermia perioperatively to optimize our patients' outcomes. As we all know, ERAS is now firmly established as a global surgical quality improvement initiative. ERAS combines the latest and best evidence to achieve rapid recovery outcomes without increased readmission to hospitals or post-op complications. Cornerstones of ERAS are evidence-based perioperative care, multidisciplinary approach, teamwork, and continuous interactive auditing and reporting. Evidence-based practice competencies are essential for all practicing healthcare professionals. They allow us to provide high-quality, safe patient care, leading to improved patient outcomes. These are just a few examples of standards and guidelines for perioperative nurses. These guidelines and standards all include the components of the SSI bundle and the best practices that are within the ERAS pathway. Enhanced Recovery endorses six core principles: patient and family engagement, nutrition management, perioperative fluid and hydration management, multimodal opioid sparing analgesia, perioperative best practices, which include patient warming, skin preparation, and others, and of course, early mobilization. The components of the SSI bundle are all included in the ERAS pathways, and these have been discussed in detail earlier by Dr. Rosario. Now, how do we link this evidence into action? Well, it's through teamwork. So I thought I'd share a picture here with you of members of our team. On the left, we have our two surgeon champions, and on the right, our two anesthesia champions. Because ERAS approach begins before admission for surgery and continues postoperatively, a multidisciplinary team of healthcare professionals must collaborate to ensure our successful implementation. So it is very important to identify your champions and early adopters. ERAS protocols require a dedicated and organized team effort. So I thought I'd share with you a picture of our local implementation team just to highlight the many disciplines that are included on this team. And I highlighted in yellow the patient representative because I wanted to stress the importance of having patient input and patient feedback. ERAS protocols and resources are widely available worldwide, and they're free. For our project, we chose Enhanced Recovery Canada. We started our program with colorectal surgery, and we chose this clinical pathway. So each member of our team took this pathway back to their own department, unit, professional group. They looked at, what are we doing now? What do these guidelines recommend? And what do we need to implement or change? What we found very useful was using a force field analysis, which allowed us to identify what we had working in our favor and what we had working against us, our barriers. And by identifying what you have working in your favor, you can come up with a plan on how to overcome these barriers to move forward. We chose an interdisciplinary approach to our implementation. So we identified 5 tasks for everyone. It is very important that everyone understand each person's role and responsibilities. And this includes the patient as well. Patients were required to stop smoking, reduce alcohol consumption, increase physical activity periodically, follow the instructions they were given, and of course, encouraged to participate in their post-op recovery. The pre-op staff's tasks revolved around education and assessment. Nutrition screening, we had not done nutrition screening before, so we included that as part of our assessment. And it's important to set that expectation for the patient around their length of stay and start your discharge planning. So you will not see the perioperative nurse mentioned specifically in these tasks, and that's because she works as part of the perioperative surgical team and helps all members complete each task. The anesthetist, no preoperative long-acting sedatives, opioid-sparing, multimodal pain management, appropriate prophylactic antibiotic therapy, which includes pre-op and intra-op, maintaining normothermia, preoperative fluid management. And the surgeon, if mechanical bowel prep is used, it must be accompanied by the appropriate oral antibiotics, avoid routine insertion of tubes and drains, use of long-acting local anesthetics, minimal basin surgery techniques when possible, and do initiate that diet on day 0 or day 1 as tolerated by the patient, but be sure to include routine post-op nausea and vomiting prophylaxis. And for the post-operative staff, reduce IV fluid administration. Most of our IVs are capped in PACU. Encourage oral fluids and nutrition. Be sure to mobilize that patient on day 0 and consistently throughout the admission. Administer opioid-sparing multimodal pain medications. And if a urinary catheter is used, timely removal, hopefully within 24 hours. While going through this process, we found that each department, although providing good care, did not really understand the work being done in the other units, and they truly didn't understand the value of their work and the contribution that they made to positive patient outcomes. So we knew we needed to foster an interdisciplinary collaboration and culture. We needed to stop working in silos. So we organized an education day. And this was a bowel education day, which included lectures in the morning and interactive sessions in the afternoon. And this was extremely successful, so successful that we now hold it on an annual basis. So as you can see, there were interactive stations that covered each part of the patient's journey, pre-op, intra-op. We even had a surgeon that showed a minimal invasive bowel surgery video, had staplers, OR instruments that other nurses would not normally see. You can see that we also included patient warming because that is important, not just interoperatively, but postoperatively as well, and pain control and nutrition as well as others. And this day was extremely successful. And these are some of the comments that we received. And I think the one that I liked the most was looking forward to implementing. Nice to have everyone on the same page. And it was true. Finally, we were on the same page and ready to move forward as a team. The one thing I like about ERAS is ERAS places the patient first and makes each person an active participant. Patient engagement is key to improving outcomes and enhancing the patient's satisfaction. So we developed some tools to help the patient participate in their care. So on the left here, you'll see the guide to bowel surgery. So this was actually a passport for the patient that they received in the surgeon's office, and they take it with them throughout their journey. So when they take it home and review it, by the time they get to the pre-op clinic, they have all their questions and concerns ready. And then in the pre-op clinic on the right, you can see they are giving a kit. And this kit includes everything they need to get ready preoperatively: their chlorhexidine shower wipes, their pre-loading carbohydrate drink, and a few other things. We also had a teaching video, which we used. And we also adopted two tools to help the patient and their family participate. Now, one of these was the meal intake. So we tried to make the patient and their family more aware of how much the patient was actually taking in and how quickly they were drinking and taking nutrition post-op. And then we had the activity tracker, and again, tried to make the patient and their family more aware and more responsible for getting the patient active as early as possible. And what we did find was that by not having the IV and taking out the urinary catheter early without those tubes and lines, the patient's family felt a lot more comfortable getting them up and helping to mobilize. ERAS requires systemic auditing to continually improve our outcomes. Auditing helps us identify pitfalls in communication, issues with collaboration between teams, and improving compliance and adherence to our ERAS protocols. So as you see, conducting pre-ERAS data is very vital. So you have to know where you've been to know where you're going. And as mentioned earlier, you need to celebrate the successes. So our CHI-HI data showed that yes, we did receive the results that we were looking for. We did see a reduced length of stay, a decreased return to ER in 30 days, decrease in post-admission related to complications, and decreased SSIs. We also monitored 12 specific ERAS indicators. And as you can see, they cover from pre-op to post-op. Was pre-admission counseling done, malnutrition screening, antiemetic prophylaxis, pre-op VTE, antimicrobial coverage, the chlorhexidine pre-wash and prep, carbohydrate loading, regional anesthesia, did we maintain normothermia throughout, glucose control, did we use multimodal pain management, and did we have early mobilization of our patient? And our data showed yes. We actually saw an improvement in all those 12 indicators, and we also saw an improved patient experience. So you're wondering, how did we measure this improved experience? Our next quick surgical reviewer interviews the patient 30 days post-op, and she gathers a lot of very valuable data for us. But she also allowed us to ask a couple of extra questions so that we could capture the feedback that we were looking for. So we asked questions like, did you feel involved in your care? Did you have a positive overall experience? And we did get positive feedback, and we continue to get positive patient feedback. So I think what I liked was, I feel like my recovery was expedited because of knowing all the steps. And I felt like I was part of the team myself. So this was exactly what we were striving for. So ERAS considers patient warming to maintain normothermia to be a key component to accelerate the patient's recovery. Therefore, successful implementation of any ERAS program needs to include methods to prevent hypothermia. So prior to implementing ERAS, we were not doing pre-warming of our patients. So we initiated a project and we did a temperature review. We actually compared one group of patients that were not pre-warmed to a group of patients that were pre-warmed. So Enhanced Recovery Canada states that patients should be pre-warmed 20 to 30 minutes prior to induction of anesthesia. The induction of anesthesia puts all patients at risk for intraoperative hypothermia. And this is because general anesthetic can impair both thermoregulation and the ability of the body to generate and retain heat. So the goal of the pre-induction warming is to transfer enough energy to prevent post-induction hypothermia. So for our study, as you see on the right, we used the patient warming gown, and we made sure that it was important that the patient could control the amount of heat. So you can see the patient control in the patient's hand. The unit itself on the wall was very small, and the hose was small, and it hooked at the very bottom of the gown, which made it very easy for the patient if they had to unhook and go to the washroom or whatever. And a great benefit of the gown we chose was that it's a patient gown, but when you take the patient to the OR, it has a second gown built in. So when they lie on the OR table, we can pull down the warming blanket that we can use intraoperatively as well. So in 2019, Enhanced Recovery Canada stated that up to 90% of our patients undergoing surgery can develop hypothermia. So it's important that we have intraoperative maintenance of normothermia with appropriate interventions in order to keep that core temp at least 36 degrees Celsius. So we had been using the forced air blankets intra-op and the heated IV fluids. We just had not been doing the pre-warming up to this point. So when we're warming our patients, it's very important that we also measure their temperature. And we have to use the same method of temperature monitoring throughout the surgical journey. Core body temperature monitoring is the most accurate. And the more accurate the monitoring, the more effective the normothermia management becomes. And temperature monitoring is equally important after surgery. Normothermia should be a requirement for your discharge from PACU. So up until this point, we had been measuring core body temperature intra-op, but we had not been measuring it in PACU. So we decided to adopt this non-invasive, consistent temperature monitoring method that you see in the picture on the right. And basically, it's a sticky patch that sticks to the patient's forehead, connected to a thin line that leads to a monitor. And the temperature monitor connects very easily to your regular PACU monitor. So our PACU nurses were very happy because now they could measure the patient's core temp and it was available consistently throughout their stay in PACU. Patient education, as you know, is very important. And patient education needs to include discussing the importance of pre-warming and how it's achieved. So the patient should expect to receive the warming gown in the pre-op area. So these were our results. And as you can see, they were significant. We saw a 42% improvement in the OR, and we saw a 26% improvement in recovery room. And with these results, we got immediate buy-in, and our team immediately adopted a pre-warming protocol. So our team came up with a summary of recommendations. The patient temperature would be monitored continuously throughout the perioperative journey. Core body temperature would be maintained between 36 and 38. Active pre-warming and intraoperative pre-warming with forced air were indicated for all surgeries that lasted 30 minutes or more. And of course, warm intravenous and irrigation fluids. Temperature would be maintained in the OR as per standards, 20 to 23 Celsius. And we established a normothermic policy for each perioperative area that did not exist before. So our study was quite successful. So I think it's very important that we realize that research has shown that even mild hypothermia can result in significant negative outcomes. So Dr. Daniel Sessler, anesthesiologist, who's the founder and director of the Cleveland Clinic, he led a 17-year-long series of studies of the effects of anesthetics on temperature regulation, perioperative heat balance, and the adverse effects of mild hypothermia. These studies demonstrated that even mild hypothermia causes numerous complications. This includes a threefold increase in the risk of surgical wound infections, increased blood loss, transfusion requirement, prolonged duration of post-op recovery, and prolonged hospitalization. And I know that my colleague, Dr. Seuss, will be discussing this in the next presentation in more detail. As healthcare professionals, we continually strive to provide safe, high-quality care to our patients. SSI bundles and ERAS pathways allow us to do just this. So I would like to say thank you so much for your time, and thank you for what you do each day for your patients and their families. And now I would like to turn the floor over to my good colleague, Dr. Seuss.
Thanks, Kathleen. Very, very interesting information from your perspective. Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Andrew Seuss. I'm an anesthesiologist at Mackenzie Richmond Hill Hospital and Coeur d'Alene Vaughan Hospital outside of Toronto, Ontario, in York Region, Ontario, Canada. It's my privilege today to have a brief discussion with you on hypothermia while under anesthesia, talking about the background of hypothermia while under anesthesia, societal guidelines, and some other helpful items. It is important to note that for my disclosures, I have given talks for 3M Canada for continuing education and received compensation from them. Our objectives today will review mechanisms behind intraoperative hypothermia, discuss advantages of various warming techniques, and review some societal guidelines for temperature management in the operating room. Temperature management for our patients is tightly regulated by their hypothalamus gland. It maintains a 0.5 to 1 degree centigrade deviation over the course of a day. It's a very tightly regulated process that maintains normal thermia from day to day. The hypothalamus is responsible for various tasks related to core temperature and receives inputs from various sources, such as skin, spinal cord, and deep tissues. It then integrates those inputs and outputs responses. It outputs many autonomic responses, which will include sweating, vasoconstriction, and shivering. However, the functionality of our hypothalamus can be impacted by various factors, including anesthesia drugs, age of patients, hormonal influences, non-anesthesia drugs, alcohol, and even circadian rhythms. One way that our hypothalamus maintains normal thermia is by triggering various responses for thresholds of various autonomic responses that maintain hypothermia. One threshold is the sweating threshold that resides just above 37 degrees centigrade and can result in vasodilation to reduce temperature, understandably. The vasoconstriction threshold is just below 37 degrees centigrade. And the shivering threshold is actually at 35.8 degrees centigrade. And by definition, if an individual is sweating, they are hypothermic. How we measure temperature reliably in the operating room is very, very important. There are five main core temperature monitoring sites in the operating room. Tympanic membrane in the ear is one. The nasal pharynx, as long as a probe is inserted 10 to 20 centimeters, is reliable. The distal esophagus is an acceptable site. Pulmonary artery or Swan-Ganz catheter tip is a very easily accessible core temperature measurement location. And a newer technology called zero heat flux thermometry is being used now. It essentially consists of an adhesive probe being placed on a selected area of the patient's forehead, which then generates an isothermal tunnel, which allows us to measure core temperature and essentially brain temperature. And this is a non-invasive means of core temperature management that is now available to us as well. Heat is produced various ways, and heat production can come from various hormones, digestion, exercise, or metabolic rate as well. And heat loss in the operating room is actually very, very important. Our patients lose heat in the operating room via four main pathways. The first is radiation, and the majority of heat loss occurs via radiation, and that is through photons. And 60% of heat loss occurs via that means. Convection is the second highest way heat can leave our patients' bodies, and that is through warm air displacement, essentially wind chill. Warmer air above our skin surface, or the skin surface of our patients, being displaced via cooler air. evaporation accounts for 10%, and then conduction via surface-to-surface contact accounts for heat loss. But 90% of the heat loss of patients in the operating room occurs via radiation and convection. And one way we warm our patients in the operating room is via convective warmers, by blowing warm air on our patients through various warming devices. And this is also a way, though we lose heat, we can also add heat back into our patients. We also have other warmers which are available, such as resistive heating and even circulating water garments and other ways to heat our patients. Our patients can lose heat as a result of our giving them a general anesthetic, and this occurs in various stages. The first stage is redistribution, and that is essentially when our patient's periphery vasodilates and warmer blood from our patient's core is cooled by cooler blood from their periphery, now vasodilated, washing into their core. As a result, the patient's core temperature drops and their peripheral temperature can elevate. This can occur quite precipitously after anesthetic. Our patients lose a significant amount of heat right after induction, and over the first hour of an anesthetic, essentially a general anesthetic, our patients can lose 1.5 degrees centigrade over that first hour. The second stage of heat loss under general anesthesia, it occurs when heat loss is greater than heat production. Over this period of time, hours two and hours three of a general anesthetic, our patients can lose an additional 1.5 degrees centigrade. And the final stage of heat loss is essentially plateau. And this occurs when heat loss essentially is equal to heat production. However, it's important to note that over the first 3 hours of an anesthetic, our patients can lose 3 degrees centigrade. During the plateau phase, as the patients are plateauing, they can lose a small amount of heat, but the first two stages are the most significant contributors to heat loss. It's important to note that patients with elevated body mass indices suffer from heat loss less from redistribution that is attenuated versus patients with lower body mass indices. The reason for this is that patients with higher body mass indices, when they're in their normal state, they spend more time vasodilated, and the effects of redistribution are mitigated by that. When our patients are under general anesthetics, we've talked about how they can lose a lot of heat, but it's also important to note that the typical processes which our patients use to maintain thermoregulation are perturbed. The shivering threshold can be reduced. We talked earlier that the shivering threshold is approximately 35.8 degrees centigrade, but it can be dropped to approximately 34.5 degrees centigrade as a result of anesthetic agents. The autonomic cold defense processes that we normally use in our bodies to maintain heat are impaired by various anesthetic agents. The vasoconstriction threshold actually drops as well as a result of various anesthetic agents. And though this is more implicated for intentional heat loss in cases of hyperthermia, the shivering threshold, while it's reduced, the sweating threshold is elevated as a result of anesthetic agents. And these include inhaled anesthetic agents such as desflurane, but also intravenous anesthetic agents such as propofol and dexmedetomidine. Important to note that our patients under spinal anesthesia also significantly lose heat as a result of, for example, vasodilation, and it's also important to be mindful of that as well. So we've talked a lot about our patients and heat loss, and there's a significant body of literature that talks about why heat loss is not a good thing for our patients. There's various complications such as cardiovascular, infectious, coagulation issues that come into play in heat loss, and I'll talk a bit about those issues and items and why we care and the literature that's in existence about them. So to start with hypothermia and cardiovascular complications, what happens when our patients with coronary disease shiver? We've all seen likely patients at one point or another with brittle angina. They can have resting angina. They're on nitroglycerin patches. What happens when they shiver after an operation in the recovery room? We know that shivering increases oxygen consumption. I, for one, would be concerned about a patient with brittle angina shivering in the recovery room, because we are then, when we are watching them shiver, they essentially are reducing the amount of oxygen that is available for their already compromised myocardium. There is a study that was released a number of years ago that looked at myocardial ischemia and increased catecholamine levels. And this was by Backlund in the late 90s. And what these study authors did was very interesting. They took 40 patients, so it was a small study, and they were undergoing surgery for peripheral vascular disease and total hip arthroplasty. And they measured circulating catecholamine levels intraoperatively. They also looked at which patients became hypothermic intraoperatively. And they then also looked at myocardial ischemia postoperatively. And what they found was an association in that patients who became cold intraoperatively, who had myocardial ischemia postoperatively, had increased circulating catecholamines intraoperatively. They had increased circulating norepinephrine, not epinephrine, but norepinephrine. And they drew an association between increased circulating catecholamines, myocardial ischemia postoperatively, and hypothermia intraoperatively. There's another study which was undertaken by Frank et al., and it was over 25 years ago. But this is a study that has been repeated many, many times in the literature in terms of our concern as anesthesia providers regarding hypothermia contributing to cardiovascular complications. And what happened was, in 1997, there were 300 patients who were undergoing abdominal and thoracic and vascular operations. And in Frank's study, these patients were split into a normal thermia group and a hypothermia group. And they noted amongst their patients that a reduction of temperature from 36.7 to 35.4 degrees centigrade increased the risk of morbid cardiac events, such as unstable angina, myocardial infarction, and cardiac arrest, and that normal thermia brought with it a 55% risk reduction. This study has been repeated time and time again. It's not a large study, but it's a study that, again, as I mentioned before, has factored into a lot of the teaching intraoperatively surrounding the worry surrounding hypothermia and contributing to postoperative cardiovascular complications, for example. Interestingly, in 2018, Shacham et al. Undertook an analysis that was retrospective and looked at over 2,000 patients, and they did not see an association between mild hypothermia and myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery. The odds ratio was 0.91 for every 1 degree centigrade reduction. This offers up a different take on what Frank found, in that patients who were hypothermic had an elevated risk of certain cardiac events. Shacham et al. Found that with mild hypothermia, they didn't see much of a change in the odds of developing myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery. Now, that being said, Shacham et al.'s study was a retrospective review and not prospective, such as Frank's. And with retrospective studies, we're often limited by the evidence base in existence when we're going to analyze it, but still noteworthy nonetheless. There are infectious complications also related to hypothermia that we are fearful of. We know that hypothermia can cause a reduction of oxygen delivery to tissues due to vasoconstriction. We know that there is, when we're looking at immune responses in our patients who are hypothermic, that there's reduced neutrophil bacterial killing as a result of hypothermia, and there's reduced collagen cross-linking and potentially tissue and wound effects in patients who are hypothermic. There was a study that was undertaken in 1996 in the New England Journal of Medicine. Again, it's not a large study, but it has many significant issues that it brought forth, one of which is risk of infections in patients who are hypothermic. This study looked at open colonic resections in 200 patients. And in the final core temperature, when it was measured in the hypothermia group, they found that that temperature was 34.7 degrees centigrade. And when they measured it in the normal thermia group, they found it was 36.6 degrees centigrade. And they found that 18 patients in the hypothermia group developed infections versus 6 in the normal thermia, 3 times the infection rate versus the normal thermia group. Now, it's important to take this into context, many bowel resections now are performed, and in particular, colonic resections are performed laparoscopically nowadays. But this study has factored in again to the fear behind hypothermia and contributing to infectious complications. There was a systematic review and meta-analysis performed by UCI that looked at over 700 patients, and they compared active warming versus no warming and the development of surgical site infections. And they found that the relative effect or risk ratio of developing a surgical site infection in the warming group was 0.36. That means that in patients who were warmed, there was a 64% risk reduction in developing a surgical site infection versus patients who weren't warmed. And this meta-analysis looked at 4 studies. Important to note, there was insufficient evidence to suggest warming reduced hospital stay or mortality in this review. Also important, if you're reading the actual article, at different points in the article, they talk about having 763 patients. And in another point in the article, they actually talked about having 769 patients. So there can be those different numbers stated in terms of patient participants in the articles. I just like to let you know all about that. But it has been cited. It is talked about. I think it's important to discuss in this presentation. Nonetheless, we're very concerned about hypothermia when it comes to effects on coagulation. Insofar as blood loss is concerned, Rajagopalan et al. Undertook a meta-analysis, and they showed that hypothermia of less than 1 degree centigrade significantly increases blood loss by approximately 16% and relative risk for transfusion by approximately 22%. And these were varied studies that they looked at, including, for example, hip replacements and hysterectomies. What's also important to note is that we know that clot formation can be affected by hypothermia. Various clotting factors are affected with reduced activity, for example, in hypothermia. We know that platelets have reduced thromboxane A2 activity with reduced temperature, and even fibrinolysis can be affected by hypothermia. Tissue plasminogen activator can have a reduced effect at reduced temperatures. So we've talked a lot about our patients and why they get cold and some of the effects that can happen as well surrounding hypothermia, and a lot of the literature that has stoked some concern over years regarding hypothermia, for example, surrounding infectious complications and cardiac complications. One thing that has come into practice is pre-warming. And pre-warming is something that increases total body heat content. And essentially what we can take is take a warmer, for example, a convective warmer, and give it to our patients preoperatively and allow them to just have a heated warming, convective warming blanket, which they can wear for a predetermined period of time. And then we add to their total body heat content. And this then can hopefully attenuate redistribution hypothermia. The way I discuss it with people and demonstrate it is, imagine you're making a deposit into a bank account from which you know you're going to make a withdrawal. We know our patients have redistribution hypothermia. If we can add to their total body heat content, they will still drop their core temperature, but they will hopefully drop it and still be in the normothermic range, or if they are hypothermic, be higher in the hypothermic range versus lower. There are a number of studies that have looked at pre-warming. We know that pre-warming for at least half an hour does have a benefit in cases 2.5 hours or longer, and has a reduced incidence of hypothermia. And this study, which was undertaken by Lau et al., looked at varied cases, for example, general surgical cases, gynecologic cases, orthopedic and neurologic cases. And they found that not only was there reduced incidence of hypothermia, but in the pre-warmed group, these patients who were in cases greater than or equal to 2.5 hours also spent less time hypothermic. There is a study on pre-warming for half an hour or less, for even as little as 10 minutes, for example, that shows that there's a benefit in reducing postoperative shivering. These were, again, varied cases, laparoscopic cases, breast cases, orthopedic cases, and even other surgical cases. And in this study, active warming was started if the core temperature was less than 36 degrees centigrade intraoperatively, is my understanding. And even in the patients who were pre-warmed for as little as 10 minutes, they had had significantly less postoperative shivering. Pre-warming for even 10 minutes reduced postoperative shivering. There's another study which came out by Jun et al. Looking at pre-warming patients for 20 minutes, undergoing spinal anesthesia for laser homeonucleation of the prostate. And they also showed that temperature upon arrival in the post-anesthesia care unit was significantly higher in the pre-warmed group versus a control group. The Cochrane Library has also undertaken a great review, a systematic review on this topic, looking at 67 trials with over 5,000 patients. And they looked at various items. One item that they looked at was infections and complications of the surgical wound, and they found a risk ratio of 0.36. However, the evidence was low quality, and that, for example, could be due to low numbers in certain studies that were looked at. They also looked at major cardiovascular complications and found a risk ratio of 0.22. That's a 78% risk reduction, but also found the evidence was low quality. And again, that could be due to small numbers in certain studies that were done. They looked at participants transfused, and they found a risk ratio of 0.79 of moderate quality evidence. They also found that chills or shivering in patients who were actively warmed was significantly reduced with a risk ratio of 0.39. So if we look at the Cochrane Library's systematic review, when taking into context active warming systems and looking at infectious complications, cardiac complications, transfusion, and chills and shivering experienced by patients, it does look like, based on this particular systematic review, there is a benefit for maintaining active body warming. One thing that seemed to not be changed by active body warming in this systematic review was all-cause mortality. Interestingly, when looking at blood loss, there was something that is definitely noteworthy that came out of this review. When I was reading this review, found it very interesting that active body surface warming reduced blood loss during surgery, but the magnitude of this effect seemed to be irrelevant. The mean difference in blood loss found to be added by warming was a reduction of blood loss by less than 50 milliliters. This seems to be irrelevant in the grand scheme of things in terms of blood loss encountered in surgery. Obviously, we want to reduce blood loss during surgery, and there are studies that show that hypothermia contributes to increased blood loss in surgery, but this systematic review performed by Cochrane showed that though there was a significant difference in blood loss during surgery, in patients having active body surface warming, didn't seem to be relevant. So one thing I've talked about is we are, for a number of years, looking at all of the evidence that we've had on warming, and a lot of the studies are small, but it has fostered a lot of our management of patients in terms of hypothermia. We feel, and I certainly do, want to keep our patients normothermic and feel that we're helping to prevent complications that they might encounter. This is based on existent evidence. Interestingly, in 2022, Sessler, who you may recognize the name in a lot of my earlier slides in this talk, undertook the largest study of its kind of which I'm aware, which involved over 5,000 patients looking at aggressively warmed patients to 37 degrees centigrade and routine care patients warmed to 35.5 degrees centigrade in a multi-center trial. And these patients were having non-cardiac surgery, expected to last 2 to 6 hours. They had to be at least 45 years of age with an overnight stay in the hospital. They were expected to have at least half of their anterior skin surface available for warming. They had to have at least one cardiac risk factor, cardiovascular risk factor, such as hypertension, diabetes, prior stroke, or known cardiovascular disease. And they were excluded if their BMI was greater than 30 or a dialysis patient. And Sessler looked at primary outcomes, myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery, non-fatal cardiac arrest, and 30-day mortality. And secondary outcomes were surgical site infection, transfusion requirements, and hospital readmissions. So a lot of the metrics that have come up again and again in the warming literature were looked at in this large prospective study. And you'll recall, based on what I was mentioning earlier, one reason we want to warm our patients is to reduce their cardiac morbidity. We want to reduce surgical site infections and transfusion requirements. And what Sessler found was that there was no significant difference in any of the primary or secondary outcomes between the patients who were warmed to 37 degrees centigrade and the patients who were warmed to 35.5 degrees centigrade. And he goes so far as to even say patients having surgery should thus be warmed as necessary to keep their core temperature at 35.5 degrees centigrade or above. Please remember that if we are having our patients below 36 degrees centigrade, they are by definition hypothermic. However, based on this study, the evidence actually is offering a different outcome than a lot of the studies that were performed earlier. So what do we do? Well, this is very interesting evidence that Sessler has come out with based on his study. But obviously, we'll still follow our societal guidelines for warming patients to the best of our abilities. The Canadian guidelines furnished by the Canadian Anesthesiologist Society stipulate the following regarding perioperative temperature management. A continuous monitoring of core temperature during cases of general anesthesia greater than or equal to 30 minutes is required. Continuous or intermittent temperature monitoring during cases of neuraxial anesthesia greater than or equal to 30 minutes is required. And the absence of surgical or patient indications for intraoperative hypothermia, active patient warming systems, control of operating room ambient temperature, and other methods should be used to target central core temperature of 36 to 37 degrees centigrade. And active patient warming equipment must be immediately available for all patients who require it. In the United Kingdom, British National Institute for Health and Care Excellence guidelines stipulate that if patient temperature is less than 36 degrees centigrade, start active warming preoperatively on the ward or in the emergency room. And that if the patient temperature is greater than or equal to 36 degrees centigrade, start active warming at least 30 minutes before induction of anesthesia, unless either of these interventions will delay surgery, that is emergency or critical. And that the patient temperature should be greater than or equal to 36 degrees centigrade before they are transferred from the ward or emergency department. These guidelines, of which there are many intraoperative guidelines for warming talked about as well, are encouraging pre-warming. These guidelines count for the redistribution hypothermia that I was talking about earlier. And I think it's very interesting that these guidelines go so far as to state how much pre-warming should be done. The guidelines from enhanced recovery after surgery for gastrointestinal surgery also stipulate use of active warming devices is highly recommended in all cases of greater than 30 minutes, and go so far as to say as well that rewarming should be performed to core temperature of 35.5 to 36 degrees centigrade prior to emergence from anesthesia. So just to recount our objectives, we reviewed the mechanisms behind intraoperative hypothermia, we've discussed advantages of various warming techniques, and reviewed societal guidelines for temperature management in the operating room. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank my co-presenters, Duncan and Kathleen, for very interesting talks. I hope that this information will positively impact your practice and the practice of your patients. And thank you for the work that you do every day.